All righty, we're picking it up on session 14, which is page 119 in your notebook. And we'll start with a little bit of review as we normally do. We're nearing the end of section 3 of your class, the third major section. There, I got it out somehow. 1839 to 1947 is the section, and we are now at 1939, just about to the end of it. 100 years of immigration. Last week, we got introduced to good old Colonial Secretary Lord Passfield, who was totally against Jewish immigration and the new Jewish national home, and he told Weizmann as much. And Lord Passfield's rejection of the Jewish national home led to the fact that he sent Sir John Hope Simpson over to the land to investigate the reason for the Arab riots and Arab dissatisfaction. Well, John Hope Simpson came back, and the result of his investigation was the Passfield White Paper. The Passfield White Paper skewered everything the Zionists were hoping for. It stated that immigration, Jewish immigration, should be restricted. Jewish land purchases should be restricted. Again, totally in contradiction to the Balfour Declaration. Of course, it was not received very well. We also learned about the Irgun, or the Etzel. This was a small Jewish terrorist organization, basically, that got formed at this time. And their logo included the land on the east and west sides of the Jordan, the whole original Palestine mandate. And their motto was Rak Kach, only this, we want all of it, basically was their idea. They were a clandestine terrorist group. Their most famous leader was Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin commanded this group during its most brutal phases. And of course, it was being a terrorist organization, the members of the group, no more than 2,000 at any one time, had to hide out from the British. They were condemned by the Zionists. So here is Begin's false identity card. He had to go under the name of Jonah Konzinghoffer and to escape the British dragnet that was out for members of the Irgun. In 1933, Adolf Hitler became the German Chancellor and Führer, and dark clouds began to settle over European Jewry. Ironically, the Nuremberg racial laws encouraged Jewish immigration and a lot of it to Israel. And these German entrepreneurs that came into Israel brought in a certain amount of money and skill and experience, and they helped improve the urban aspect of Israel and the industrial aspect of Israel. Industries got started. One of the more well-known industries was the Palestine Potash Works, now known as the Dead Sea Works. Potash provider provides one-fourth of the world's supply of fertilizer. So they're a big deal today, mining the Dead Sea for its minerals. The Arab Higher Committee was formed by the Mufti. This committee was formed to unite Arab resistance against the British mandate. And they began by ordering a strike and an insurrection. The strike and insurrection were headed by Fawzi al-Kwakji. He headed up the guerrilla bands that caused all the problems. This strike lasted 7 months and, ironically, was more detrimental to the Arab community than the Jewish community. It took Arab produce and Arab workers out of the way, and so Jewish workers and Jewish produce, for example, began to dominate in the Holy Land. So eventually, the Arab Higher Committee was talked out of the strike, and the strike eventually came to an end after 7 months. Then the British sent the Peel Commission to Israel to try and analyze what was going on and figure out a solution to the friction between the Jewish and Arab communities. So they came up with a revolutionary idea. This is the first time it was suggested that Palestine be divided into a Arab state, which would be the green. And remember now, the Balfour Declaration has been reinterpreted. Everything to the west of the Jordan River is now Palestine. Everything to the east is Transjordan. So this was to be the Jewish national home, but it'll be subdivided into the Arab state, which is the Judean hills and the Negev, that's the green area. The Jewish state would be the seacoast and Galilee, that's the yellow area, and then there'd be a British enclave around Jerusalem and Bethlehem and with a corridor to the sea. So that was their recommendation in 1937. So what were we seeing? Again, the area allocated for the Jewish national home by the San Remo Peace Conference in 1920 was this area. This was the British mandate for the Jewish national home. But in 1921 to 23, the British reinterpreted the mandate. Everything to the west is now Palestine. Everything to the east of the Jordan River is now Transjordan, given to King Hussein. But now, with the Peel partition plan, the Jewish state gets even smaller. It is limited to the coastal plain and Galilee. So basically, Satan is working overtime. He's working overtime to squeeze the Jewish state out of existence. Why does he want to squeeze the Jewish state out of existence? Because the Jewish state is part of the Abrahamic covenant. Remember the Abrahamic covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 tribes, containing three promises. The key promise we're concerned about here is the land promise. God promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the Jewish people territory, a certain swatch of land that would be called home. And if that land exists, then that promise can be fulfilled. If that land does not exist, then God is, and the promise can't be fulfilled, then God is shown to be unreliable and weak. He can't keep his promises. And so Satan's career is safe. Remember that. Always remember this. That no matter what the British do or the Arabs do, underneath all of it is the prince of the power of the air. The one who influences this world, Satan himself. And of course, when anti-Semitism raises its ugly head, it doesn't make sense on a human plane. You have to go down to the spiritual plane to understand what's going on. Satan wants to destroy the modern state of Israel. He also wants to destroy the Jewish people. So that's why anti-Semitism and all this is so relentless. It never stops. Humanly speaking, it would have stopped long ago. But it won't stop because this is not humanly inspired. Okay? So much for my sermon. All righty. Now we're on page 119. Middle of the page with the Arab revolt. Because the Peel Commission suggestion to divide Palestine into an Arab and Jewish state was rejected by the Arabs. Zionism was called a cancer, and the Palestine mandate should be terminated immediately, was their position. All right, so now Arab revolt. Now at this time, the Arab choice of alliance with the Axis powers, remember it's the Axis, not the Allies, the Axis powers was systematically being encouraged by Rome, that's Italy, and by Berlin, that's Germany. Throughout 1937, the Palestine issue opened new opportunities for Nazi activity in the Middle East. Grobe, the German minister in Baghdad, was increasingly in contact with Arab nationalists and members of the Palestine Arab Higher Committee, assuring them of German opposition to the Peel plan. In September, Syrian nationalists requested German weapons be shipped to the Arab rebels in Palestine. In November and December, the president of the Arab Club of Damascus traveled to Berlin on behalf of the Mufti to seek German financial and military help. And these appeals did not go unanswered. So in this atmosphere, violence was inevitable. For example, Sunday morning, September 26, 1937, Louis Y. Andrews, District Commissioner for Galilee and Acre, and a known friend of the Zionists, started out on foot for church in Nazareth with an assistant and a police constable. As the men turned up a narrow, steep lane, they were fired on at point-blank range by a group of Arabs. Andrews and the police constable were killed instantly. By mid-October, this is 1937, mid-October of 1937, violence surpassing the level of the previous year raged throughout Palestine, with attacks on Jewish settlements and buses and the murder of Jewish civilians. Note, for the first time, British patrols were cut down by snipers. Note, British soldiers were first attacked by Arab guerrillas, not by Jewish guerrillas. So as the killings and sabotage increased, so did the British reprisals. From July to November of 1938, when the uprising was at its worst, at its fiercest, perhaps 16,000 local and imported guerrillas were engaged in the insurrection. They succeeded in almost completely paralyzing civil authority outside the nation's larger cities in the Jewish agricultural areas. By mid-October, the rebels virtually had taken control of the old city of Jerusalem. But this was the high point of the uprising. Page 120. By the end of the year, by the end of 1938, some 20,000 British troops were launched on a campaign that was hardly less than a second military occupation of Palestine. And even these heavy troop concentrations barely managed to restore a semblance of order in the northern and central districts of the country. The fighting among Arabs, Jews, and the British ultimately claimed several thousand lives and inflicted millions of dollars in property damage. Even in exile, the Mufti, Haj Amin, was making a supreme bid to consolidate his power in Arab Palestine. Here is you've seen Haj Amin with the Arab Higher Committee. Here is a close-up of the man who was most antagonistic toward Zionism of anybody. This guy was at the top of the mountain. His Eminence, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin Effendi al-Husseini, the guy most opposed to Zionism. All right, stockade and watchtower settlements. Now, after the issuance of the Peel Report, the Jewish Agency was convinced that the partition of Palestine was imminent. It was certain, too, that the boundaries of any future Jewish state would be determined by the practical evidence of Jewish habitation. Now, how did they come to that conclusion? Well, just on Sunday, I got this article from the Times of Israel that relates to that question. Israeli spies bugged the Peel Commission at the Mufti's Jerusalem Hotel. Here's how they got their information. Israel's pre-state Haganah military force spied on the meetings of Britain's Peel Commission in a Jerusalem hotel in 1936 and 37 and rushed to establish dozens of new Jewish settlements in what was then British Mandatory Palestine, in part because they realized the commission would otherwise offer the Jews sovereignty in only a very small section of the Holy Land, a TV report revealed on Saturday night. I got this the Sunday. The commission was headed by Lord William Peel, which was set up to investigate the causes of unrest in Palestine and wound up recommending the partition of the Holy Land. They were headquartered from late 1936 to mid-1937 in what was then the Palace Hotel in the old city of Jerusalem. The hotel was built by the then Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, a fierce opponent of Jewish statehood, who would later collaborate with Hitler's Nazi Germany. The Haganah planted listening devices in the chandeliers of the hotel, the TV report said, exploiting the expertise of two of its officers who had been involved in the building's construction, an engineer named Baruch Katinka and a telephone communication expert named Yeshayahu Feinsod. Relatives of the two men and other academics detailed the story to Channel 10 News Saturday night in a report that coincided with the reopening this month of the palace, which has been rebuilt at a cost of $150 million and is now renamed Jerusalem's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. So if you go to the Waldorf Astoria, it's a historic place. Listening in on the commission's deliberations, pre-state Jewish leaders increasingly internalized that they were likely to be offered only relatively small areas of the contested territory. They therefore dispatched Jewish pioneers to take physical control of territory that had already been purchased by the Jewish National Fund in 52 locations in what was known as the Tower and Stockade Campaign. Fascinating, huh? That's how they knew. They bugged the British. They listened in. Isn't that fascinating? All right. So, accordingly, land was now purchased on the borders of Palestine, especially in western Galilee, and matched by immediate settlement. In order to provide instant protection for the young kibbutz members, a tower and stockade method was devised. The emphasis here is on prefabricated construction. So a site would be selected, basically, and the settlement would be partially assembled, you know, beforehand, some other location. What was at daybreak an empty patch of ground, by nightfall would be covered with a solid encampment protected by an outer stockade and a wooden tower and a searchlight. There was little concern for economic viability in this crash program of settlement. The most urgent priority in the late 1930s was simply to achieve a Jewish foothold, even with the barest nucleus of pioneers in the outlying regions of the country. All right, 1938, Wingate. So as the Arab uprising of 1936 and 1939 drove on, the Jewish community took up the posture of active defense. Yitzhak Sadeh, the Haganah field commander, pioneered this concept. Remember him? You've seen this picture early on. General Yitzhak Sadeh of the Haganah. We have to have an active defense. In addition, the mandatory government, which was hard-pressed for military manpower at this time, authorized the existence of 3,000 gafirs, uniformed Jewish auxiliary guards. And even more significantly, the man appointed by the British as operating commander of the gafirs, Captain Ord Wingate, vigorously and imaginatively enlarged Sadeh's concept of an active defense. So here's a picture of Major General Ord Wingate. He was a captain at these times. He would rise to the rank of Major General in the British Army. He was a Bible-believing Protestant. He was a passionate adherent of the Zionist cause. He told his closest friend, David HaCohen, here it is, "I count it my privilege to help you to fight your battle. To that purpose, I want to devote my life." Very few Wingates around, I tell you. "I believe that the very existence of mankind is justified when it is based on the moral foundations of the Bible." There he is. He's solidly sitting on Scripture. Praise the Lord for Ord Wingate. Wingate eventually became a confident of Weizmann and the Jewish agency leaders. Page 121. In studying the Arab tactics, Wingate noted the manner in which the guerrillas would strike and escape from heavily armed government columns. He was determined to retaliate by developing fast patrols and placing emphasis on night operations. Wingate was authorized to organize the gafirs into special night squads. With official approval, Wingate was able to innovate a technique even more aggressive than that employed by Sadeh's semi-legal Haganah units. The young Scottish officer's tactical ability in the field, his leadership, his resourcefulness, soon evoked the admiration of his Jewish troops. So did his method of exploiting the night with every trick and feint and decoy to carry out audacious surprise raids against guerrilla hideouts. Indeed, Wingate's conception of an active defense went so far as to include crossing into Lebanon and into Syria and attacks on guerrilla villages there. That is an active defense, isn't it? The best defense is a good offense, you guys. You learn that in football right off. Throughout 1938, during their scores of forays and ambushes, the Jewish special night squads inflicted heavy casualties on the Mufti's rebels, and they kept them off balance and increasingly ineffective. Well, Wingate himself was considered expendable. His pro-Zionist views were becoming an embarrassment to the government. Eventually, in the spring of 1939, he was sent back to England, and his superiors wrote this. in his file. If you read his file, this is what you read. A good soldier, but a poor security risk. Not to be trusted. The interests of the Jews are more important to him than those of his own country. He must not be allowed to return to Palestine. So accordingly, in the front page of his passport was written the words, "The holder of this passport must not be allowed to enter Palestine or Transjordan." Now Wingate ultimately wanted to lead a Jewish army into battle against her enemies, but he never got his wish. Brigadier General Ord Wingate was killed in a plane crash while fighting in the jungles of Burma in World War II. 1944 is when he died. However, the Haganah's ability to cope with the rebellion infused new confidence into the Jewish community. Now we come to the Woodhead Report. I will refer to it as the Woodenhead Report, but that's just my bias. It was in reaction to the mounting Arab violence in Palestine that London announced the impending visit of, guess what? Yet another commission. This one to determine methods by which partition might be carried out and to recommend boundaries for the proposed Arab and Jewish state. So remember, we had a commission in 1921, a royal commission in 1930, a royal commission in 1937. Now we get the Palestine Partition Committee in 1938. The commission was chaired by Sir John Woodhead, page 122. So the commission arrived in the Holy Land in April 1938. The Arabs boycotted the Woodhead hearings, rejectionist strategy. Instead, the mandatory officials presented the Arab cause no less effectively than the Arab Higher Committee. The mandatory officials were traditionally hostile to Zionism. Now, three plans were proposed. Here's Palestine Partition Commission Plan A. The Jewish state will be the coastal plain and the Galilee, the orange area. Okay, you see that? That's the Jewish state. But there was another proposition. You know, the Arabs refused that one. Palestine Partition Commission Plan B. The Jewish state will be the coastal plain and eastern Galilee. Notice that western Galilee has now become a British mandate. See that great big red blotch? Let me back up here. Let's see if I can back up. There's the original plan. Here's Plan B. Now, continuing to look at Galilee, here's Plan C. The Jewish state is the coastal plain only. Isn't that great? Huh? So, the Peel Partition Plan is this one, 1937. The Woodhead Partition Plan now divests the Jewish community of the Galilee. Now we're just the coastal plain. So, Satan continues to try and squeeze the Jewish state out of existence using political means. Okay? The squeeze is still on. November 10th, 1938, the Palestine Partition Commission report, the Woodenhead report, was submitted to Parliament. It declared the Peel Partition Plan unfeasible. So they gave up. Predictably, the Zionists were enraged at the Woodhead report. The Arabs, though less critical of the plan, rejected it on the grounds that it still envisioned Jewish sovereignty, even in diluted form. November 26, 1938, yet another white paper was issued, this one formally rejecting as impractical any notion of dividing Palestine. The statement resorted instead to a familiar observation that, and you hear it today, the surest foundation of peace and prosperity in Palestine would be an understanding between Arabs and Jews. An understanding that has never existed and doesn't exist today. Not a realistic view of the Middle East. To that end, the government announced its intention of inviting representatives of the Zionists and of the Palestinian Arabs and of neighboring Arab states to a conference in London. If negotiations did not produce an agreement within a limited time, the government would make a policy decision itself and enforce it with or without Arab or Jewish cooperation. The talks were known as the London Roundtable Conference. So after the initial phase of the uprising in 1936 and 1937, London had admitted that the Palestine mandate was unworkable, a claim Arab nationalists had advanced from the start. And of course, the Arab nationalists made sure the plan was unworkable. That's the whole point. We decided it was unworkable from the beginning, and we are going to make sure that holds true. Now, the second phase of the Arab rebellion was followed by abandonment of the partition plan, well before any effort could be made to put it into operation. Notice the next sentence, mark it up moment. The Arabs plainly had mastered the crucial lesson. We talked about this last week. They had mastered the crucial lesson. Violence on behalf of their rights in the Holy Land was effective diplomacy with Britain. Violence will get your way with Britain. All right, Kristallnacht, economic ruin of the Jews. The start of the Holocaust, November 9 and 10, 1938, the night of broken glass. This is not in your outline, of course. Here's some pictures. Jewish storefronts in major German cities were attacked by mobs and the plate glass windows destroyed. That's why it's called the night of the broken glass. And you can see the Jewish storefronts here. I believe this is in Berlin. Here is a Jewish shop owner busy trying to clean up the mess. It was a German pogrom, November 9th and 10th, 1938. Synagogues were burned. Not only were German businesses attacked, synagogues were burned. This is a synagogue going up in Bamberg. And Jewish citizens of Germany were arrested and harassed. And notice these German ladies and this German man. Do they look Jewish to you? No, they're assimilated as German could be. But they were harassed, some thrown in jail. That was the beginning of the Holocaust. Now, of course, we as Jews only survive because we can look at this with a little bit of humor. And here's some Jewish humor about Kristallnacht from the book Jewish Humor by Rabbi Joseph Talushkin, Amazon.com if you want to pick it up. Here's some jokes for you. Here's how we survive. The Zionist leader and Israel's first president, Chaim Weizmann, declared in the late 1930s, there are two sorts of countries in the world, those that want to expel the Jews and those that don't want to admit them. So where are you left? You're left floating in the ocean. In 1939, a Viennese Jew enters a travel agent's office and says, I want to buy a steamship ticket. Where to? The clerk asks. Well, let me look at your globe, please. So the Jew starts examining the globe. Every time he suggests a country, the clerk raises an objection. This one requires a visa. This one is not admitting any more Jews. The waiting list to get into that one is 10 years. Finally, the Jew looks up. Pardon me, do you have another globe? You guys, the United States has been the best haven we have ever experienced in our history. This country has been the best to us of any country in history. Finally, when Hitler rose to power, there were two types of Jews in Germany, pessimists and optimists. The pessimists fled into exile. The optimists went to the gas chambers. Well, we've come to just about time for our break, and after the break, I'm going to show you a DVD from Against All Odds, Israel Survives. It's program number 9, entitled The People of the Book Come Home. We've been looking at 100 years of Jewish immigration, 1839 to 1939. And now our reporter is going to try and find out, he's going to ask in Israel, is this a miracle? Can you explain what was happening here? Okay. Unfortunately, he says, after World War II, Jewish immigration started into the Holy Land. He gives the implication that Jewish immigration didn't really begin till after World War II. We have seen that it's been going on for well over 100 years. So, you know, that's a little error in the DVD. Anyway, pay attention to the opinions he gets when he interviews people. Is this, the Jewish people coming back to our homeland, is this a miracle? Can you explain it? Just pay attention to responses are. Okay, go ahead and take your break, and we'll watch the DVD after. And you guys on YouTube, you'll have to pick it up somewhere on the internet, and we'll give you the address on YouTube.